Okay, welcome back. It's going to be a very interesting hour, and I really am very grateful for our special guest who will be on here in just a moment or two. If you understand anything about vehicles and the way the society works, you understand already that somewhere around 40 to 45,000 Americans a year are killed on the highways, roads, byways, alleys, freeways, interstates, whatever. A lot of people die. The number of injured is over 3 million a year. But somehow, for some reason, those numbers are okay. Nobody's bitching about it. It's an accepted way of life. Now, that said, I'm going to also suggest that those numbers are going to be going up because of what the hospitals in this country have become. And what they are doing now, without any question of a doubt, it's all proven. They are killing people with full and utmost intent. They are being paid cash bonuses, varying amounts of money for varying achievements, so to speak, with the dying patients. They are, of course, billing the patients or billing the government for the hospital costs, everything from labs to the bed to the nursing to the MRIs to the medications, you name it. Hospitals are making a fortune on death. I know that's difficult for some of you, but not this audience. Some of you who may be new to the program say, what the hell is he talking about? I'm talking about the truth. And if you look at the top of the homepage, we're going to hear more about that story in just a minute. Let me welcome back my colleague and partner, Erica Kahn, who is with us an hour earlier from now on to get more people involved with this. Erica, are you there?
I'm here, Jeff. Good evening.
Welcome back.
Thank
okay.
you.
The top story at the homepage is astonishing story of hospital attempt to murder a car crash victim by claiming he had COVID. Hospitals cannot be trusted any longer. Many are engaged in financially incentivized murder, mass murder, a holocaust of murder. Before this is over, oh my. And with the Biden mandate coming down the road, I think it's around the 23rd or 24th, to face 12 million professional healthcare workers who will now have to take the bioweapon injection or lose their jobs, they're going to walk. And many, many hospitals and clinics are going to shut down. Watch. That's what's coming. But what was done to this gentleman, his name is Ben, we'll leave it at that, is one of those things that is almost beyond belief. For many, it is beyond belief. And Ben wrote in, and I guess he saw the story at the top of the homepage. He's familiar with the site and the program. And he said, tell Jeff I'll be happy to come on. And here he is, just a few hours later. Ben, thank you very much for being here. Say hello to Erica.
Erica, hello. And Jeff, thank you for having me this evening.
Hi, Ben. Glad you're here to tell your story.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a close one. Yeah,
it was a close one. That's, you know what they used to call those? Your one free one. When you get by something.
Well,
in my case,
I'm going on about 8 or 9. So.
Well, you know what I'm talking about then. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. This happened in the great state of Arizona. Tell us what happened, Ben. Just walk us through it. We'll stop and talk along the way, but I want to hear this story from you. This is amazing.
Sure. It was last Sunday, so January 30th. The crash happened really close to my house at about noon or thereabouts. I woke up earlier than I wanted to. I took a valerian root, which I've never taken in the morning, and laid in bed, couldn't fall asleep. And then after a certain period of time, I was like, you know what? You're hungry. You didn't have much yesterday. And I went to a local restaurant just down the road, and I started feeling unwell. Let's just put it that way. I was there but 15 minutes or so. I hadn't even ordered. And I just was like, you know what? Go home and lay down. It was, you know, I didn't sleep that well the night before. And I never made it home.
May I ask again, Ben, hold on. Please. You took valerian root to try to get to sleep. Was that it? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, but it was the first time I ever took it in the morning.
Oh, okay. Okay. And
but
what
after
kind
I
of
gave
a...
up, you know, I laid in bed and it just twisted and turned and was like, this is not happening. Like, just go get
some
food. And I just started
What car did you have?
It was a Jeep Grand Cherokee Laredo.
Okay. All right. Very good. So you're at the restaurant and you don't feel very good. Go ahead.
Yep. So I decide not to order. I'm like, just go home. You'll be able to sleep now. And the next thing I knew was just a giant impact, roll, bam. I mean, it just happened so fast. I might have lost consciousness. And the car somehow ended up on all four wheels. So it flipped once and it ended up the way, you know, a car normally is just parked. And I was very shook enough, of course, and confused, but I was alert enough to look around and take an inventory of what had happened to the car. First thing I noticed was almost like the gel-like appearance of the windshield, which had not, that had not blasted out entirely. It was just spider-webbed. But the driver's side window was all broken out. The passenger
side
window was all broken out.
You were still in the car when you woke up, or came to, so to speak, right?
Oh, yes. I was sitting upright like you would if you were just about to start your car.
Okay.
So then I moved to my body, and I just started moving my limbs around, and I was wiping. There wasn't much blood, but I was wiping. You know, they were superficial, all from glass. So every cut that ended up on me was exactly the same depth into my skin, which was not deep, no stitches, nothing. So anyway, I'm like, I'm okay. Like, holy crap, what the heck just happened there? And I'm sitting there, and it wasn't more than probably 7 to 10 or 12 minutes where I saw units arriving. And I only had one interaction, and that was with an EMT, which, you know, they're going to get to you first, whatever. I don't recall him even asking me any questions, but I do remember him removing a syringe from a little casing. And I protested immediately. I just said, yo, dude, what are you doing? No. And he's like, I'm just going to calm you down, boss. And from that point forward, after that needle went into my arm, it was just utter blackness.
Okay, hold it right there. First of all, I'm amazed at your presence of mind to say no to an EMT in a situation like that. Now, Erica, let me ask you, as a biophysiology expert, what are they giving a sedative to someone before they've even given a cursory diagnosis of what this man might have been through and what injuries he may have suffered in this rollover crash? What are they giving him a shot to knock him out for?
I'm drawing a blank. I don't know. That it seems a little unusual. But I've been, you know, I've never worked as an EMT, so I don't know. That it does seem strange.
Did you hear them, Ben, on the two way, like getting instructions? Well, give him 10 milligrams of this or that. Anything like that? Or this guy just came up to you and shot you up?
There were three individuals in the background. The man who came to my window and put the needle in my arm was large. Like, he was a big dude. But I could tell that there were some individuals standing further back. There were like three, probably 10, 15 feet from him. So they were not actively involved.
Hell, they didn't even take you out of the car.
No, because ultimately, before they even got there, I tried to open the door, but it just—it was bent just enough that there was no way it was going to open. And then both the passenger side window and my side window were sharp pieces still kind of sticking out, so I couldn't climb out. So I was pretty much trapped in the car.
Okay. All right. So they gave you the shot, and you just go into la la land. You're gone.
I'm gone.
All right, take us forward.
And then the next thing I knew is I was in a hospital bed with a vent, and this sort of brilliant, energetic thrust of light, like adrenaline just came over my whole body. And it's almost like my hands knew where to go and what to do immediately. I just was like lifted from the depths of several layers underground, it felt like. You know, all the weight of whatever opiates and hours and hours of these opiates coursing through my body, and just something punched through it. It didn't feel like me,
off.
Jeff. It didn't feel like me. It felt like something else. So,
this, if I might say, this is a little reminiscent of what I went through in 2015. I woke up after being in a coma basically for 4.5 hours, and it was like my eyes popped open and I was fully aware of what was going on around me. I asked questions, says, where the hell am I? I was in ICU. But it seems to me that something may have reached inside you and pulled you up out of those depths you've been describing of blackness. I mean, you were gone and you were pulled up into the light.
Right. Well, and I cannot stress enough how much energy we're talking here. So just think of it physiologically. If you're under for that many hours, and it's about sitting somewhere 6.5 to 7 hours total,
sure,
of sedation. If you do happen to wake up, there's going to be a grog like you wouldn't believe for a long time. Well, this was not the case. It was full energy, clarity, confidence. I was unafraid. I did not feel afraid at all. So I started slowly removing that intubation tube.
Now, let's tell our listeners what an intubation tube is. Some may not know. They put this thing down Ben's throat so he can breathe. Now, that's a pretty big step forward, and it's usually a last step in hospitalizing someone and treating them when they're seriously, very seriously ill with lung issues. I wonder why they intubated you. I don't know. Strange.
Well, I think if you had to sedate somebody so heavily that their breathing slowed down that much, I know that
there
they
you
will
go.
Intubate people.
There
but,
you go. All right.
That's what they had done to me, but so anyway, I made sure, like, after I pulled that tube out very, very slowly, that I followed the tube with my eyes and turned my head, and there was that machine with all its readouts, and I could feel that tube coursing slightly. It wasn't like a heavy-duty vibration, but I could feel, you don't, put it this way, you don't intubate somebody with nothing on the other end of that tube. Something's being put into your lungs and then drawing out of your lungs. So I pulled it out. I knew it was a vent because I could feel it and see it, and I know what they look like. And then I went for the IV, which was in my left arm. Mm-hmm. So I pulled the tape, and then I slowly took out that needle. That wasn't so terrible. And then I realized there was a catheter, and that was the worst part, pain-wise,
ouch,
of this ordeal.
Yeah.
So I slowly pulled that out. It was excruciating. And there was kind of like a little pop at the end, because I believe they put, there's like a balloon on there that holds it in place.
Right.
So you can imagine, like, you don't want something bigger than your urethra coming out of your urethra. I would imagine it's like passing a kidney stone or something like that.
Fair enough. And there's no one looking in on you. No one's in the room. You're alone.
Well, Jeff, that's what's so interesting. You would think that even if people exited the room, they'd have some manner by which to monitor anything that was removed.
Yep, I agree.
Something should go like ding, 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 you know, room blah, you know, malfunction, or no, I had all the time to remove all of these devices from me, grab the hospital sheet, the bed sheet, cover my genitalia, which was bleeding profusely, and I looked down and I'm like, okay, that's, this white sheet's not working. Okay, so I found my shorts. They had been cut off me. They were black. I put that over.
Mm-hmm.
And then I waltzed right up to the door. I opened the door. There was four staff members sitting at a desk to the left, and I immediately said, why the hell am I in a vent? And their faces, they didn't respond to me. They were just looking at each other like, what is happening right now? And so after a moment, they said, sir, go back to your room. And I was like, no. And I did back up enough to get in the doorway and kind of put both arms up in kind of an assertive position. Right. Sort of like, I don't know what you would do on a football field if you didn't want someone to get past you, or, you know what
gotcha.
I mean?
Yeah.
And I continue to ask the question, why in the world would I be on a mechanical vent and I want to speak to a lawyer? And nobody's saying anything. They're looking at each other. They were like juvenile. Like their mannerisms were juvenile. They just look like they couldn't even answer. So we ended up all getting back into the room, but I remained standing. I didn't want to go too deep in that room in case they had called some big lug down from floor, whatever. And he's going to just re-inject me and hook me right back up.
Mm-hmm.
So we're standing there, and I go, again, why did you put me on this ventilator? And the young staff member, she looked like a nurse, said, because you have COVID, in like a super snotty,
just like that, huh?
Way.
Wow.
Yeah, like, because you have COVID, like that. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I said, even if that's the case, that is like the last resort for a COVID patient, according to their stupid protocols. We all know it's bullshit, but
that's
I'm
right.
sorry for it. But, like, she, you know, I was like, no, like, that's not what you would do. That's what you would do if somebody's lungs were no longer working on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, what drugs were in that IV? And she didn't answer. And I said, what drugs were in that IV? And the three that she named were propofol, fentanyl, and morphine.
Fentanyl and morphine. Wow.
I talked to a couple people today that feel fairly strongly that morphine is the drug that the EMTs would have, if any,
mm-hmm.
because that'll knock you out pretty good if they need it to knock you out. But propofol is and fentanyl are extremely powerful drugs.
Those are heavyweights. Those are go to sleep for forever drugs. Yeah.
Right. And as we all know, like the trick that they played, and it was illustrated perfectly in Perspectives on the Pandemic that came out in 2020 with the infiltrator nurse at Elmhurst, they would give up to 7 sedatives to people who are having situations as minor as panic attacks, asthma attacks, et cetera. They get them on a couple of those drugs real quick, right? And then their breathing slows down, duh. And then the oxygen saturation levels
control.
Lower because they're breathing slower. And that's the justification from going from a CPAP or mm-hmm. some sort of topical oxygen delivery system
mm-hmm.
to ultimately the ventilator. So they step you down through the drugs until your vitals are like those of someone who's suffering a health issue. But guess
Got
what?
It.
That's what those drugs do. So they're medicating you into an induced sickness, quote unquote, to justify then the use of the ventilator. And once you're on the ventilator, statistically, you never leave.
That's 85% fatality when you go on those things, you don't come off. That's really astounding on several different levels. Erica, go ahead. Those are some very powerful drugs to give someone who was just in an automobile crash who has yet to be properly and fully analyzed in terms of what injuries he or she may have. That's powerful stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't even sound like they did an assessment at the scene. You know, they whip out the needle and you don't even have a chance to say no. So that makes me think, you know, if this is what it's looking like, that the EMTs and the paramedics are all in on this scam, too.
It's not
sure
the first
does.
Time that I've heard that postulated, that's for sure. That I don't know. I mean, but nothing would surprise me at this point. Nothing would surprise me whatsoever.
I mean, if you were alert I would think the first thing they'd ask you is, you know, are you in pain? You know, can you move? I mean, you know, did they ask you any of those questions?
I don't recall any questions being asked to me.
They just jabbed
you. Yeah, so,
wow.
They told my family, you know, like after I left the hospital, and we can get into the manner by which I left, but that I was combative at the scene. And in a way, I don't understand it because my interaction was so brief. On the other hand, if someone ever told me, okay, we got to get you to the hospital, I'm going to protest because I know what's going on.
Right.
I've been, I've said to myself so many times over the last couple of years, well, beyond that, even before COVID-19, like, stay out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. So they might have just said, they may have said, we're going to get you to the hospital. And I would for sure.
And you said,
I did a self-assessment, you know.
I got it. So they jabbed you and you were gone. Now, when you were at the hospital, we're going to go through the break, Todd, thanks. When you're at the hospital and they said, that little snotty little female said, you have COVID. Did they explain to you how they came to that determination? Ever?
No, they didn't. That's when I launched into, you know, what I already said, which was like, even if that's true, mm-hmm. you don't just jump me all the way to end of life COVID protocols.
Boy, you said that perfectly. They did jump you right to the end of life protocols. That's exactly what they did.
Right. And I want to stress that at no point did any staff say we had to do this because of this. The only explanation, the only word that was said was COVID. They did not say like, hey, listen, you had a minor surgery or you had a major surgery. You know, nothing was performed on me. They did say, I said, do I have any trauma? Did you take MRIs, x-rays, that sort of thing? They're like, you have no trauma, no head trauma, no internal injuries. Well, then what are you doing? So I needed no surgery, and yet you're keeping me under for 6-7 hours?
Wow, that's incredible.
It gets weirder too, Jeff. There's a lot. There's
okay.
There's more since we spoke briefly earlier this afternoon.
Okay, go ahead. Let's carry on. Go on.
Well, just moments before I hopped on here, I got a fourth communication from the medical records department, and I had sent my ID, the front and back, to authorize them to release this. Because I've been talking for the listeners, like I've been dealing with these people all day. I sent my request for authorization of medical records certified, which arrived Saturday. Records is closed on Saturday. So I got on the horn right away on Monday morning when they opened and got somebody on the phone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she was like, okay, they're not sitting here. They haven't delivered the mail to the department. So I'm like, okay. 2 hours later, she calls back. Yep. Still no luck here. Can I call you back in a couple hours? I'm like, yep. Then she called back and she goes, okay, we have your request form. There's a couple issues with it. You checked every box. Now you didn't see a behavioral therapist, did you? And I said, nah. She goes, do I have your permission to cross that line out? And I said, yeah, sure. And then she said, okay, well, all we need then is an ID front and back. And I said, okay, that's great. So I went ahead and sent that. And then I just got this 41 minutes ago. It said, got your documents, but there is no authorization form attached. I have attached one for you. Once you submit your authorization form, we can continue processing your request. The document attached is the one that I sent them. That they received certified mail. So
got it.
I said in reply, hi, Rhonda. That is what I physically sent to you by certified mail. That's what was in the envelope. I'm confused. Thanks, Ben.
Uh-huh.
So now they're starting me over. You see what's happening here?
Sure. Rewind. Yep.
Oh, yep,
like, please send the form, sir. Like, basically, they're doing these 3D animated version of a robocall. You know, they're feigning a robocall here. Like, please press one if you'd like to, you know, it's like we literally were talking about me telling you it's okay to cross off a line. You held it in your hands while we were on the phone. And now you've just asked for that same document. that you had in your hands.
This is incredible. I wonder what the death rate is at that hospital vis-a-vis admissions.
Well, I don't know what's, you know, the long answer of that, but I do know that one of the reasons that Mickey Willis from the Plandemic series is going to be meeting with me on next Tuesday is because they were already going to Flagstaff for a case.
Ah, wow.
So something's going on over there.
Yes, yes, yes. The word's out somewhere. That's fascinating.
Right. Well, judging by the look on their faces when you came out of the room, you might have been the first one to ever challenge them on what they're doing. I mean, they seem pretty confident they were going to get away with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, can you imagine how used to this rookery these people are?
And yeah.
I'd be willing to bet that less than probably 85 to 90% of the sort of underling realm at that hospital has any idea that remdesivir is bad, that I sincerely believe that most of the sort of garden variety hospital workers just think that the hospital is trying to save people. I think it's the top. And I think it's those who take orders from the top and then give orders below them.
Yeah, it could be.
I mean, I guarantee probably that they've never had someone pop up out of bed like that.
A COVID fatality in a hospital is worth anywhere from, I projected it, $200,000 to $500,000, depending. There are a lot of ways to figure it in. But they get over 100,000 cash bonuses for varying things, like diagnosing someone with COVID, putting them on a vent, they get more. There are many things. It's over $100,000 just in cash bonuses the hospital gets. It sounds like you went into something, the kind of thing that they might make a Hollywood movie out of. This is really bizarre. Evil stuff.
Yeah, the man that rented me the short-term room to come and do the project that I was going to do here, which I'm not doing anymore for obvious reasons, keeps telling me I need to watch the Mel Gibson movie Conspiracy Theory. I never saw it, but apparently there's like a waking up, and you know what I mean, like out of a nightmarish thing. But so then do you want to continue with how I exited the situation entirely?
Tell us the story. We want to hear it. And how you got out, too, especially. That's there's something going on there. So,
right. So as picture like a semicircle of these staff around me, I'm maybe 10 feet tops in the room. And I've got the front of my body facing that door in case someone comes at me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not getting in their face, but I'm just asking questions. They had a million opportunities to de-escalate the situation, to say anything comforting, like the reason we had to do this procedure is not because of COVID, it's because of this, and I would have listened. Or they could have said, we have been reaching out to your family, or we talked to a member of your family, or anything like that, or saying my name. Like, in a de-escalation situation, sometimes just the very act of saying a person's name can give them a center for the experience.
Understood.
Brings you back into yourself a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
At no point did they say my name. At no point did they answer any question besides the snotty, because you have COVID, and the three drugs listed. Those were the only questions that were ever answered of mine. They didn't actually offer to let me call somebody until the very, very end. So this wrangling and this communication is going on for probably 40 minutes, 45 minutes. And then a fresh face walks into the room. It's another woman, and she has a little ripped off piece of paper, and she goes, would this be a good contact for you? And it was my sister's name. And I said, yeah, but I just want to leave. And so everyone exited the room for probably 10 minutes, and I stood in the doorway again, just in case someone tried to rush me. And by the way, the way that this facility looked, or at least a part of the facility that I was in, didn't look like any hospital I've ever seen. The hallways were dark. There was no hustle and bustle. This was around 8 p.m. So it's a, this was not like an overnight thing. There was one single wide steel door to my right, the desk I referenced earlier to the left. Never did I see anyone else coming down that hall. And
this is too weird.
For a while. They came towards me and said, "This is the doctor.
Yeah.
And if you can do a couple things for her, we can't keep you here." So what that thing was, she only actually made me do one thing, and that was to produce urine, which I'm going to go ahead and call blood because that's what it was. But she just wanted to see that there was flow, because you can get a clot from all the blood in your urethra.
Yeah.
And then if you can't pee,
right,
then you know, you're in trouble or whatever. So
right,
I was able to do that. And then I asked for an adult diaper and some clothes. And one of the younger, I don't know if these younger guys were security, I guess they might have been, he returned in about 4 minutes or so, and he had an adult diaper. That weird nurse that had come in and asked me to produce urine, I said, "Can I get a little help?" Like, I've never put on an adult diaper, and she helped me put this thing on. I put on these scrub type of pants over that. There was some sort of hippie looking tie-dyed hoodie. I put that on. It was way too tight. It was hilarious. It was just like, what? And some shoes that were too small. And then at that point, I go, "So I'm going?" And they go, "You can go." And there was, I said, "There's no paperwork. There's nothing after, you know, because you, like, if I walked out that door and then fell down a flight of stairs and didn't sign a release, you know what I mean? Like, it's against the, it's
sure,
called against medical
AMA
advice.
Against medical advice, yep.
So they were like, no. Like, they just let me go. So the two young men led me to this solid steel door, same type of steel door you see everywhere. And they opened it, and I go, "Seriously? I can go?" And they're like, "Yeah." And I go, "How do I get downtown from here?" And they pointed straight, and they said, just go that way and you'll run into it. It was 9 degrees in Flagstaff that night, and it was about a mile and change to the place that I ultimately found to try to get help. And I didn't feel the cold whatsoever. I mean, I was still jacked up, I'm sure. You know, the adrenaline overrode whatever drugs those were. I didn't feel tired. I felt steady on my feet. I walked briskly. I, you know, had that spirit of just like, I'm out of there. I made it out of there.
Ben, and if I might say something, you have described absolutely nothing that sounds like an advanced contemporary hospital setting. This sounds bizarre. Beyond bizarre.
It's beyond bizarre. You know, even some of my sort of center friends, white bread, average, non-conspiratorial thinking people that work in medicine,
sure,
have said that they've never heard of anything like this at their facilities.
I haven't. Do we have a name for the? I don't want you to state it, but do we have a? You've got their name and their address, right? It's a real hospital,
yeah,
right?
Well, I would tell, without being specific, Flagstaff has one hospital.
And that's it? And that was the
Flagstaff,
one you were in?
Yeah, I was in the only hospital they got.
Well, all right. This is too much. This is creepy as hell. Wow.
Like, Jeff, it looked like, you know how when you were a kid in school and the teacher, you gain the teacher's trust enough to run errands for them and stuff? Like,
yes,
you could go to the AV room and wheel in the TV, or they would send you on errands because they trusted you.
Yes.
This looked like when you would go down into the basement of the school, but it was like the boiler room area. that's how unlike a hospital this section or this building was. It had no semblance of hospital vibe whatsoever.
I can't tell anyone what to do, nor would I, but if it were me, I would start digging into that hospital's annual reports, their records, how many fatalities, how many alleged COVID victims there were. This has to be, this hospital has to be under the aegis of some municipal body in the government there in that town that will enable you to get some information. You obviously you've got some work to do ahead of you. This is not normal, not at all. Nothing normal about this that I've heard yet. Nothing.
No, like every level of protocol was completely tossed out the window. The only thing that is potentially semi-protocol is I did read about some instances whereby you would sedate a person at the crash scene, and sometimes people are intubated depending on what that sedation is. But after, so I've long since kind of just pushed that aside, because to me it's all about what happened at the hospital.
Oh, sure.
I mean, we got to remember, I was uninjured. So what protocol should be is that, okay, the scene was the scene. We've run some tests on this person. There's no internal bleeding. There's no concussion. There's no, you know, major laceration.
Oh, orthopedic exam, of course. All that. Yeah.
Right. All of that is totally fine. And I, you know, they claimed that they did these things. Mm-hmm. Then what you would do is let them come back to life and have someone gently sit next to you and tell you where you are. That we're reaching out to family. Maybe you can help us reach out to people. You're uninjured. You're lucky. This is a good day for you. You're not seriously injured.
Wow.
You know, some of those normal things that you would do in any sort of traumatic, experience to turn the situation into something positive and then push it a little bit more positive and make that person feel at ease.
It sounds like they didn't even have an ICU there, which you should have been in, at least until they thoroughly had evaluated you. This is crazy.
And there's no way for me to know, however, like, if I was in another section of that hospital and
well,
they
you were
just
drugged
wheeled
out.
Me down to the boiler
Course.
Room.
Sure.
Well, I wondered, I mean, do you have insurance? Could that have made the determination where you end up in that hospital?
I do not have insurance.
So, yeah, you might have been selected to go to the basement, you know, for the different kind of treatment.
But they wouldn't have known whether or not I had insurance because they didn't even know my name. And they actually claimed this records person I spoke about earlier that I had the four different conversations and now she doesn't have my release form again.
Yeah.
She said that we still don't know who you are.
Oh. But they
well,
were
how
able
in the
to get
world
a hold
did
of
they
your
come up to me with a pe- How in the world did they have my sister's name and didn't know who I was? So not only did they talk to my sister, they didn't ask my sister who I was. And
well,
here
they
we
must
are
have
a week later
the,
and she says to me on the phone, you know.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm just thinking they might have got it from your registration, the license plate or the registration on the car or driver's license.
That's a no-brainer. Of course, they do that.
Yeah.
They go through his wallet. They pull his license. Any other cards he's got in there, people are easy to figure out. This is no big mystery. This is really weird. Yeah.
I was told by the Copper Canyon Fire, which was the EMT, in an email that, because I was looking for my things, you know, after this. I was like, where's my wallet and my phone? You know, what the heck's going on here? And he said in an email that he said, we don't make a habit of rummaging through people's cars. And I was like, but police do. So I called them and they said, oh, we don't have it. And I go, do you have an accident report? I haven't gotten around to it. And I'm like, okay. So, and I've been looking every day on crashes and the registry for, you know, you always report every little dumb thing, right? It doesn't come
you
up
used
anywhere.
To.
You know, I want to say,
well,
I want to say something.
Yeah.
Ben, let me say this. It almost sounds like you were put in the COVID one way out of the hospital, i.e. the back doors to the morgue, and then they were going to get their big payoff from the feds or whoever's paying them. It sounds like you were definitely scheduled to die.
Marked, yep.
That's what it sounds
like. That's what it felt. That's what it feels like to me. There are just too many layers of protocol that were breached. And here we are a week later, and I'm having these bizarre interactions with the records department.
Well, let's say every COVID death at that hospital.
The lady who was holding my release form and said, can I cross this line off?
I authorized that.
You're asking for that form again.
Yeah. If every COVID death generates for a hospital $300,000 to $500,000, that's pretty tempting. And it doesn't take many people to pull something like that off. The behavior of those people when you came out of that door or opened that door, it's like they were used to people not coming out of that room walking.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it sounds like. No, this is
absolutely
speculative, because I wasn't there.
Another point sort of to focus on the money is that during the first wave of COVID, think about all of the, think of everything that they pulled from hospitals, all unnecessary surgeries, cancer screenings, all manner of screenings. So they pulled financially from the hospitals first and crippled them with all that. And then they got all this fake, phony money to reward the COVID protocol on top. So the hospitals had makeup to do. I mean, remember when they were furloughing all these people and, like, all these, you know, health workers were out of a job? They were all furloughed, and yet we had a pandemic. And no one could get screened for cancer or get a mastectomy or, you know, all these different things. And
I hope you can get a good lawyer. I'd settle for $5 million after taxes, maybe. This is crazy. I've never had anything like this in my life. It's downright creepy.
No, I still can't entirely wrap my head around it. But I feel oddly calm. You know, I've been so, my life, I typically lead a very relaxed life. I get a lot of stuff done without feeling edgy or anxious, and I time things in a certain way so that my mental health and my physical health are doing okay. And I think, like, the barrage of response and love, quite frankly, that has come from so many people has helped me deal with all of this extra busyness and constantly keeping up with people. Like, I almost, Jeff, after we spoke briefly today, completely spaced in interview. I was just, my mind was ever, you know, that's how fast things are moving with this. And hopefully this will be the one thing that exposes what they've been doing for 2 years.
Well, I hope that's what happens. They're probably well girded with their own attorneys. We'll see. You'll find out a lot of things. This is going to be quite a journey for you. I'm very glad to have had the ability to put that video of yours up at the top of the homepage, because it's being looked at all around the world now, which is good for you, because people need to know there are things going on in this country that are absolutely wrong on many different accounts. I don't know what else you want to add, but that you've done a heck of a job describing something that is straight out of the Twilight Zone. This is just bizarre.
Well, I would say that I'm maybe more than lots of other people am uniquely versed in dealing with extraordinary situations. I've got to get around to writing a book about it. My whole life has been bananas, but a lot of it is comedy, you know, like impossible scenarios, impossible comedy, lots of weird, bad things, but always escaping. I'm a musician, a songwriter. I don't promote myself. I put out an album a year and then I throw it up on Facebook maybe twice. because I can't stand talking about myself. But I just wanted to mention that I had a song I put out a few years ago called "I Keep Not Dying." And all the verses of the songs are about real things that have happened to me. Mm-hmm. So this is just another kind of interesting thing for me. I had a feeling the last year without, you know, I'm not an activist. I don't have a channel that I upload videos to. I'm not looking for attention. But I had this weird feeling that I had something to do with exposing this. It was just this weird little kernel inside of me that never turned into a frontal lobe thought about, well, what does that mean? I never thought about what it meant. I just felt like maybe I could be part of busting this open. And then this happened.
Well, those little voices, those little kernels of feeling sometimes are the biggest voices of all. Erica, you have any other questions for Ben?
No, I commend you. You're really a brave person for doing this, and I think you've got some guardian angel on your side, and you know you're being instructed to what to do, when to do it, how to do it. So keep it up.
Yeah,
I
hope that you shake this thing down all the way to the floor. This is nuts. I've never heard more unprofessional behavior in my life. In an alleged healing institution, never. This is really.
Yeah, I hope this can end up helping other people. My advice for everybody is be extra, extra, extra careful. Do not go to the hospital if it means looking up how to sew up a little thing that needs 10 stitches. You know, home remedies for this, home remedies for that. Get yourself healthy. There's a connection between what you eat, how you think, and how your ultimate health outcomes turn out. So
you bet.
There's a lot of wickedness going on in the hospital, so please try to stay out of them.
Ben, thank you. Times 10. We really appreciate what you've contributed here, and you have made a difference in a lot of people's lives with your video and your explanations here tonight. This is really something people will remember. So you're doing the job already. So congratulations. Keep it up. If I can be of any help, let us know and we will help you.
Thank you so much for having me on, Jeff. And I'm just certain this won't be the last time we talk.
Very good. I agree. Okay. All right, Ben. Good night.
Okay. Thank you, Ben.
Bye.
Bye.
That is a Twilight Zone story for sure. I've not heard anything that ghoulish.
It's surreal.
Before.
It is. It's absolutely surreal.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know where to. It was. I guess you know if we want to go meant to be. He knows the site. He knows the program. And he sent a note in saying he just tell Jeff I'll be happy to come on, something like that. And I called him right back, and here he is. And we had other things.
Yeah, that's an absolutely
tonight.
Crazy story. I mean, right from the ambulance ride. I mean, I shudder to think if these paramedics are a part of this charade too now. I mean, who can you count on?
I have never heard of anyone being injected into oblivion in a crash situation like that before.
Not without some sort of evaluation. And,
none.
You know, he was alert, he was conscious, he was sitting up, and just
yes.
The first thing they do is whip out a needle? Too
no
many
more
needles.
Needles.
These days.
No more needles. No more needles. Eric and I had a lot planned for tonight. We will do it Wednesday for all of you. This just popped up, and it was meant to be. So I'll put it up. I'll put the audio up, and you can share it if you want. The video is right at the top of the homepage. He does a very good job of explaining it in a relatively few minutes, but you heard the long form. So there we go. Again, our thanks to you, Ben. It wasn't his time, Erica. It wasn't his time.
Oh, that's for sure. That's for sure. There's other forces working here, no doubt.
I couldn't agree more. All right, Eric and I will be back on Wednesday. Thanks, my friend. Take care.
Okay, Jeff, thank you. Good night.
Okay, good night. Back with more in just a few minutes.